One, two, three, four.
Welcome to Song Salad with Shannon and Scott.
I'm Shannon.
And I'm Scott.
I'm a professional writer and your resident lyricist.
And I'm a professional musician and your resident composer.
And together, we toss up a new song each week.
Using a random music genre.
And a random topic.
That's right. Using our proprietary, patented, industrial-strength salad spinner, we randomize over 500 music genres.
And then hit the random article button on Wikipedia to get our topic.
Yep. Tell our listeners what we did last week, Shannon.
Last week, we wrote an adult contemporary song about the anime Girls und Panzer.
Tanks on tanks on tanks.
We were thankful for Tank School.
We were.
Last week. And had a really fun time writing about a show where high school girls train and then pummel each other with heavy artillery.
And I would give us a B minus on that song.
B minus is passing.
Exactly.
Like, well passing.
Yeah. Some songs we do are A pluses. That wasn't one of them.
That's okay. It can't all be hits. You know, you gotta experience grief to truly know what happiness is. You gotta hear Thankful for Tank School in order to appreciate Pork Companion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Our greatest hits.
Honestly, I just can't remember anything past 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Pork Companion stands out.
Yes, certainly.
Well, let's see what's in store for us this week as we fire up the salad spinner to generate our genre and topic.
Fire it up!
This week, we are writing a... Art rock song about... Dick Gebhardt's 2004 presidential campaign.
It's perfect. It's beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
Oh, goodness.
It's what song salads are made for.
This is what mwah, kismet, like amazing.
So an art rock song about Dick Gebhardt's 2004 presidential campaign.
So art rock, right off the top,
yeah,
makes me think about math rock.
Yeah.
Because anytime you put just like a big abstract term in front of rock, you know it's going to be a thinker. You know?
Math rock or prog rock,
yeah,
progressive rock. So I bet art rock has a lot of like weird elements.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like soundscapes and like very like long extended sequences of like experimental music within a rock song. Like when we talked about prog rock, we talked about bands like Rush, which had these like, you know, long kind of like jam band songs that they would perform. So I bet art rock can have these similarly long songs that are just for listening.
Just for listening. You got to be so careful with them. They're just for listening. Don't play with them too hard. Don't touch it. Don't dance on it. Okay. It also makes me think of, here's the other, I'm just like frig associating here. It makes me think of art songs.
Oh, okay.
So how would you define an art song? Because I'm kind of coming up a little short on it.
So an art song in the classical music world is usually a piece written for a solo singer,
right,
and a small instrumental ensemble, sometimes just piano. And it's a standalone piece, so it's separate from an opera or an oratorio,
yeah,
something like that. And it's usually just like a poem as the text, or...
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like, it's text that's not necessarily created to be set to music,
yeah,
initially. Like it's can be like found a letter or like you,
sure,
said a poem, mm-hmm, or something else. Yeah.
So I don't know if there's any overlap with art rock, but that would be interesting.
Yeah, we can see.
So what do we know about Dick Gebhardt's 2004 presidential campaign?
I know his name.
Yeah, I've heard of the name too, but I wasn't paying attention in 2004 really. Because I wasn't of voting age yet.
Yeah. I mean, I was 16, so I don't really recall.
Yeah.
Just, I know the name. But it seems like the perfect esoteric topic for an art rock song, doesn't it?
It definitely does.
It felt so good when we spun it.
just because I feel like art rock lyrics are probably going to be about big esoteric things or like very specific topics that you wouldn't necessarily usually sing about.
Right, 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 right.
So it feels like it'll work.
I am so excited to write some kind of freaking T.S. Eliot poem about Dick Gephardt and have you put it into a rock song. I am J. Alfred Proof rocking this.
Oh my God. That's fantastic.
Okay.
Or you could also do a, who wrote the Jabberwocky, the poem?
C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, you could do like that kind of a poem about like.
Humpsy doodle. Yeah.
Mimsy was the Gebhardtsy. Yeah.
Great. All the things that rhyme with Gephardt. What a good idea.
That's going to be good exercise for you today.
Oh, jeez.
All right, let's learn more about art rock.
Let's do it.
I'm feeling artistic.
Yeah, we're going to be real good at this.
We can go places with this.
Yeah, it is pretentious in a fun way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So art rock is rock music that has avant-garde and challenging content. Makes use of modernist, experimental, and unconventional elements, and wanted to elevate rock from just entertainment to an artistic statement.
Right. So none of that piddly diddly Elvis crap.
Right. Not meant for dancing, meant for listening and contemplation.
Musing on the nature of life, the universe, and everything, you know?
Right. Right.
Which is why the lyrical themes for it tended to be quote unquote imaginative.
Mm-hmm.
And also occasionally politically oriented.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Making a statement.
Yeah. And it had a pretty short life, you know, in its height of popularity. It was really the late 60s and early 70s.
Okay.
And emerged mostly from British artists. So some of the bands that were pioneers of art rock included the Velvet Underground, David Bowie, Frank Zappa. The Beach Boys are included here with Pet Sounds. The Beatles are included with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. So a lot of these like concept albums.
Yeah.
Including Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd or the rock opera Tommy by The Who. You know, any of these albums that made a broader artistic statement rather than just having like a set of songs that went together on the album.
Have we talked about concept albums before?
I don't think we have.
Yeah, I don't think we have either. So to generally explain them, I mean, you kind of just did. It's like all of the songs are strung together with a larger theme. And they may also actually just tell a story straight out. Like there may, especially in the case of like a rock opera, like The Who's Tommy, there is a real narrative that you are following throughout.
And a weird narrative in the case of Tommy.
Truly weird. He's a pinball wizard, you guys.
But then if you think about like Sgt. Pepper, you know, that's probably more, you know, one of the more mainstream concept albums, but it includes songs like For the Benefit of Mr. Kite, which is all right. Like just reading the text off of a circus flyer. You know?
Right. And also that album featured a lot of Indian-inspired music and other maybe seemingly incongruous or at least like new kind of world music influences all at the same time.
Right.
So you get into that kind of experimental territory.
Yeah. So that's one of the main defining features of art rock is that it's not just music from a rock band. It incorporates a lot of sound effects, ethnic music, and soundscapes, these sort of like fantastical elements, and experiments with the vocals too, like pitching the vocals in different way, doing a lot of like background vocals and harmonies in ways that weren't heard previously in rock music.
I want to say that I called this shot from a million miles away, and I am super proud of myself.
Okay.
Because there is a music critic, Bruce Eder, and he wrote The Early History of Art Rock / Prog Rock, and here is a quote. Bands are playing suites, not songs.
Mm.
borrowing riffs from Bach, Beethoven, and Wagner instead of Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, and using language closer to William Blake or T.S. Eliot than to Carl Perkins or Willie Dixon.
You called it.
I called T.S. Eliot. Yes. I'm just so pleased with myself that I grokked this hashtag aesthetic from a thousand yards, you know?
Grokked?
Grokked?
What's grokked?
It's like understood.
Oh, it's, never heard that.
It's sci-fi slang from, hold on. Bummer. It's sci-fi slang. It means to like understand something intuitively or by empathy. And it was coined by Robert Heinlein, who wrote Stranger in a Strange Land.
Oh.
Among other things, he was a novelist in the 60s and 70s.
Fitting.
And a huge misogynist, actually.
Oh, boo.
If you read his stuff, it's quite terrifying.
No thanks.
Yeah, but anyway, but grokking is kind of, it has made its way into the lingo.
I thought you were saying like gronked it. Like
Rob Gronkowski.
Like Rob Gronkowski, because you snatched it out of the air like a football. Look at that football reference we made.
Are you sure gronking it isn't you just walk into a room and slam your head against anything that's close to you? Oh, I gronked it.
That's probably more accurate.
Oops.
One thing I wanted to point out here is that the difference between art rock and prog rock.
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that.
Is that prog rock is characterized by its employment of classically trained technique and symphonic textures.
Okay.
So we, in our prog rock song, talked a lot about how the instruments were played virtuosically, and like keyboards and pianos, for instance, were played like in a classical and virtuoso style. But that's not really part of art rock. That gets into prog rock territory. So we can stay away from being virtuosos.
Yeah. There's also less literary content in art rock versus prog rock.
Okay.
And for anyone's reference, who cares? If you want to look up our prog rock episode, it was Learn Your Way Toward the Light.
Yes.
which was a prog rock song about a like business school in England.
All aboard the Ark of Education.
That's right. All aboard the Ark of Education.
So let's play some examples.
Yeah, let's find some.
Let's play a little bit of Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite from the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And Money from Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon.
The celebrated Mr. K performs his read on Saturday at Bishop's Gate. The Hendersons will dance and sing as Mr. Kite flies through the ring. Don't be late. Mrs. K and H assure the public their production will be second to none. And of course, Henry the Horse dances the waltz.
Some of these songs.
One
thing about something is that a lot of them are long.
Yes.
Like prog rock was like this too.
Mm-hmm.
They're, because they are opuses, you know?
Yeah.
They have something to say and they're going to take as much time as they need to say it.
Right.
They are suites, not songs.
And if you saw the movie Bohemian Rhapsody about Queen and Freddie Mercury and the creation of the Bohemian Rhapsody album, you'll know that the whole goal of that album was to write like a night at the opera, but with rock music, you know? So like, I think a lot of bands around this same time period had that idea, like we need to do something different and something experimental that's never been seen before. And that included these like long, suite-like tracks. And then it was in the mid to late 70s that punk came on the scene and rebelled against this artistic expression in rock and kind of took over. And that's when art rock fell by the wayside.
In the song Money,
yes,
you hear the sound effects.
Yeah.
And the sound effects actually are being used rhythmically. So it's not just like you're adding a sound effect. It is like right. You are making the sound effects a texture or an instrument in the song.
True. And there was a little bit of that in the Mr. Kite example as well. There's like the sound of the like calliope, which is the organ that sounds very circus-like. So it just kind of puts you in a mood and in a space and gives imagery to the song that reflect the lyrics.
We also listened to another song on off of Dark Side of the Moon, The Great Gig in the Sky.
Yep.
Is that what it's called? Where the vocal was just a woman like vocalizing.
Belting her face off.
Yeah.
Without words.
Yeah. Which is experimental. So I think it's really kind of no rules just right as long as we're feeling it. You know, like yeah. Get naked, put paint all over your body and roll around on the canvas, baby.
Right. Well, especially with artists like Frank Zappa, and you have these really irreverent, weird lyrics like Don't Eat the Yellow Snow and a lot of profanity and like descriptions of sex. And so I think we kind of have free artistic license this week.
Over Dick Gephardt.
Over Dick Gephardt. In the great year of our Lord, 2004.
I am very excited.
Okay, so it's time to research our topic.
Mr. Gephardt.
We're coming for you. Dick, 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 Dick. That's why you didn't win. That's your chant. Dick, 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 Dick.
Stop trying to make Dick a thing.
Dick tried to make Dick a thing in 2004.
He did. I don't know if his first name or his last name is worse.
Gephardt.
Gephardt.
With a DT at the end.
The DT. I don't know. Gep.
Well, if you combine the PH to an F sound, it's Gephardt. Dick Gephardt. Dick Gephardt.
I like Dick Gephardt.
Dick Gephardt.
Okay. Dick Gephardt.
I haven't actually like researched deep enough to see how you pronounce his name, so it's possible.
I'm sure it's not Gephardt.
It's not Dick Gephardt.
It is not. This man is a career politician.
He is.
And after he got out of politics, after his second failed presidential run, he became a lobbyist.
Yep.
And like a labor consultant. He's 77 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he had quite an interesting earlier career.
Yep.
With most of the action happening.
Well, when you're a young politician, yeah.
Yeah, in the 80s. He was actually in the 80s and 90s, I guess early 90s, was the minority leader of the House.
Yes, that was 1995 to 2003.
There you go. Before Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah. He was a Democrat. I don't know if we mentioned that. And he ran for president both in 1988 and 2004. And what's interesting to me about that is that in 88, he ran against George H.W. Bush. And in 2004, he ran against George W. Bush.
George regular Bush.
Isn't that strange? I wonder if there's many other people that have run against a father and son for president.
I don't know. I feel like you'd have to ask like the kings and queens of like a country where that's way more normal for somebody's son to also be president.
Right.
His more interesting presidential campaign, I think, well, there were a couple notable things, but in the 80s, he actually got pretty close to the Democratic nomination.
Uh-huh.
Though he finally ultimately lost it to Dukakis after Dukakis ran an ad that made fun of his flip-flopping voting record by using a Dick Gephardt lookalike doing flips in the ad. So that's pretty cool.
What a great gig for a gymnast.
Yeah. He got into a fight. Well, one
he
of his staffers... It would be better if he got into the fight.
Yeah.
One of his staffers got into a fight with one of, remember Howard Dean?
I'm still sad about Howard Dean.
I know.
He was the front runner.
He
was the reason that Gephardt's campaign took a dip, but he famously ruined his chances at getting the nomination because he got very excited at, what was it, a town hall or a press conference?
It was just like a rally, I thought.
It's a rally, yeah. And he just kind of like shouted like a madman, and that clip went viral.
Wait, can I try to do it?
Do the Howard Dean.
He went like this.
It was as if he was sitting on a horse and like propelling it forward.
Remember when that was enough to sink somebody's
presidential campaign?
Remember when that was the bad thing?
Ugh. And Gephardt lost to that guy.
Oh my God. I have wonderful news.
Well, we didn't go into the story.
Wait. Okay, fine. Go into the story, then I'll tell the wonderful news.
So one of Gephardt's staffers got in a fight with one of Howard Dean's staffers at a meeting and called him the F word, but like the really bad F word.
He called him a slur for gay men.
Yeah. Or a bundle of sticks.
Yeah. So lots of weird feelings flying around.
I had a lot of weird feelings in 2004.
Yeah. Oh, did you?
Hey, the height of hormones and...
2004, the height of hormones.
That would have been my campaign slogan.
When you ran for class president or whatever.
I was a freshman / sophomore, right? What a time to be alive.
I have wonderful news.
What's your wonderful news?
Mr. Gephardt is on Twitter.
Please, Mr. Gephardt's my dad.
Call me Dick.
Call me Dick.
He is on Twitter.
What's his handle?
His handle is Dick Gephardt. Okay. His bio is as follows. Husband, father, former Democratic House Majority Leader and Minority Leader, President and CEO of Gephardt Group, co-author of The American Immigrant. The last time Dick Gephardt tweeted, and I know you were interested in this, was April of 2018.
Oh, wow.
And he tweeted, "So proud of my grandson, Ernest, for choosing such a wonderful hero for his project." And Trisha Gephardt, who I'm guessing is Ernest's mom, had tweeted that little Ernest had chosen civil rights leader John Lewis as his project.
Oh, John Lewis.
It is amazing to me that someone named a child Ernest.
That's your big takeaway?
It kind of is. I mean, John Lewis is amazing, but...
There was a moment in the 2004 campaign when it was reported by the New York Post that Dick Gephardt had become John Kerry's running mate and vice presidential candidate. But shortly after that story broke, it was revealed that John Edwards was actually chosen as the running mate.
Oops.
So it was compared to the Dewey defeats Truman article from 1948. So maybe that's some fodder for song material.
It very well might be. It seems like in recent years, he's taken up the cause of immigration.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He does a lot about, he posts a lot of articles, in the past 2 years, I'd say, about, supporting immigrants and refugees and fixing our immigration system and talking about people who have helped build this country but may not necessarily like get the protections and stuff that they deserve. So it seems like that's his pet cause at the moment.
That's great.
Yeah.
I mean, he served in Congress for over 25 years. So kind of what he knows. So to summarize, Dick Gephardt ran for president as a Democrat in 2004, didn't get very far.
Right. So, let's bring it back to art rock.
It always comes back to art rock with Dick.
In the end, it's about art rock.
So the lyrics can be a little bit esoteric, a little bit abstract, maybe.
Yeah, I'm going to give you my best T.S. Eliot impression here.
Right. Now, what would you say are the hallmarks of T.S. Eliot's writing style?
Oh, Jesus.
It's a natural question.
Yeah, hold on. T.S. Eliot.
Who is he? What makes him tick?
So T.S. Eliot was a modernist poet.
Oh.
You might recognize...
Cats.
Okay, we can talk about cats. We'll talk about cats. Yeah, in case you don't know, there's some stuff in cats that comes direct mail from T.S. Eliot, the love song J.F.R. Prufrock. So, yeah, he was a modernist poet, and you might recognize some of his contemporaries, which would be Ezra Pound and E.E. Cummings. There are many other modernist poets, and in addition, that kind of whole cohort was also involved in playwriting, and they were essayists and they were critics. But yeah, mainly T.S. Eliot today is known for his poetry. And modernism was a reaction to the horrors of World War One.
Oh.
And because before World War One, the kind of prominent style of poetry, I guess, or the poetic movement that I think most people would be most familiar with prior to World War One was Romanticism.
Makes sense.
You might recognize Romanticism because it is, oh gosh, you know, it's like what you think of when you think of like flowery British poetry. And to be clear, we're talking specifically about like the Western canon, like Western European canon of poetry at the time.
Yes, of course.
But when you think about romantic poetry, it's all about like the personal sentiment and the elevation of the poet as an artist who is giving voice to his or her sentiment as like, and the expression itself is... the art and the craft is highly valued. And there was also an exploration of like certain themes. Ones that people might be familiar with are the sublime, which is like the pursuit of things that are beyond our comprehension or measure.
Okay.
And so a lot of the time that had to do with like love and duty and like fidelity and like all these big ideas,
big concepts,
but how they were felt personally through the poet. And then another thing that you might recognize is like a kind of fetishization, I would say, of like medieval themes and times and Hellenistic themes and times. So like if you think about, oh gosh, what's that poem, Ode to a Grecian Urn?
Oh yes,
which is a Keats poem. Mm-hmm. So it was like, why are you talking about Greek pottery, John Keats? Anyway, so the modernism that kind of came out of that after World War One, the world really kind of flipped on its head after World War One, as far as like, that was really the kind of huge shift to modern warfare and the death toll. And
was staggering.
Yeah, it was absolutely. And the method of violence was just kind of unseen and unheard
of
in World War One. And you really saw like World War One, there were like horses, but then there were also like tanks. And it was kind of like
a weird intersection of time.
Yeah, exactly. And so anyway, so modernism came out of this, and the idea of this visionary poet who could change the world through their poetry sort of became repugnant to modern writers who had lived through the war. And what they wanted to do was give voice to a more authentic psychological state.
Okay.
And the way that they did that was this new kind of poetry that was talking about still the internal reality of the poet, but trying to make the internal reality of the poet and all of its like nooks and crannies and fragilities and, you know, unpleasant parts universally available and accessible to readers.
And rooted more in like psychology Or is that not
kind
part of
it? I mean, it was rooted in an intellectualism.
Sure, I guess that's kind of what I meant.
I mean, it's really hard to sum up an entire artistic movement in my random rambling. But let's talk about the love song of Jail for Proof Rock for a second.
Okay.
Which is the first really big thing that T.S. Eliot became famous for.
Mm-hmm.
And T.S. Eliot, I didn't realize he was American. And
I always thought he was British.
Yeah, because he moved to Britain when he was 25, and then he renounced his American citizenship and became a member of Great Britain.
Doesn't sound too bad.
I know, right? Help.
Well, not much better over there right now either. Sorry, guys.
Yeah. So I'll just read you something from, this is actually from Spark Notes on J. Alfred Prufrock, but it says... The love song of J. Alfred Prufrock demonstrates a sense of indecisive paralysis as the speaker wonders whether he should eat a piece of fruit, make a radical change, or if he has the fortitude to keep living. Humanity's collectively damaged psyche prevented people from communicating with one another, an idea Eliot explored in many works, including A Game of Chess, which is the second part of The Wasteland.
Hmm.
And if you remember, if you ever studied the love song Jail for Prufrock, this was like the first time in school that I remember really connecting with poetry.
Okay.
Was Prufrock, because before that, all of it seemed a little too like sanitized and buttoned up for me.
Right.
And this was the first poetic movement that really spoke in a kind of vernacular that felt close.
Because it was a little bit unfinished in its thoughts, or like opened more to interpretation.
I just mean there's a really big difference between thou still unravished bride of quietness, thou foster child of silence and slow time, and I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floor of silent seas.
Yeah.
The first one is Keats and Ode to a Grecian Urn, and the second is Eliot. And Prufrock.
Makes sense.
So Scott mentioned cats. And if you know, I'll try to find the like actual little verse of it.
Okay.
But there's a line in Memory in Cats, which goes, burnt out ends of smoky days, the still cold smell of morning. A street lamp dies. Another night is over. Another day is dawning. And you can kind of see that in verses from Eliot, like...
Half past one, the street lamp sputtered, the street lamp muttered, the street lamp said, et cetera, et cetera. Also, remark the cat which flattens itself in the gutter.
To spit out all the butt ends of my days and ways is like the burnt out ends of smoky days.
There it is.
I remember very distinctly not knowing that connection. And mm-hmm. then reading the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock in 11th grade English and being like, what's happening?
Well, and then the lines I was reading were from Rhapsody on a Windy Night, which is a different poem.
Oh, interesting.
By T.S. Eliot. So there's connection throughout his oeuvre.
Yes, indeed. Cats, of course, written by Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber.
And Tim Rice.
Yes.
Okay.
That was a very long... diversion, but you well, asked I mean, me a it, very complicated question.
And it was important to dive into, because if you're going to be writing the lyrics in a T.S. Eliot style, we need to know what that means.
Yes.
So now we know.
Indeed.
And, you know, just a very quick side note that the trends in poetry that you mentioned at that time in history were also the trends in music at that time in history.
Oh, cool.
Music was very lush and romantic and focused on those big ideas, like you were saying. And then after World War One, we got into more avant-garde and atonal and dissonant music and got more experimental with things. So trends in art.
With Shannon and Scott. Half-baked trends in art. Sorry for our poor summaries, any art historians out there.
And now we need to combine art rock and Dick Gephardt.
Okay, here's what I think my angle is going to be.
Tell me.
And we'll see if it holds up when I actually start writing it. I think we can dive into Mr. Gephardt's interiority of losing the campaign,
losing
the nomination.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it can be a kind of meditation on failure.
Ooh.
In a life marked by also accomplishment.
Sure, that
so
makes
like,
sense.
So, like, how do you measure the...
Measure a year.
No, stop. We can't start. How do you measure the worth of a man, of a woman or a man? Damn it. I can't stop. But yeah, how do you weigh the kind of balance at the end of your life of
accomplishments versus failure?
Yeah.
But also of a failure which most people that attempt it experience.
Right. Yes.
And in his case, twice.
Indeed. And I think and you know, that to say that romanticism focused on Hellenistic and medieval imagery and themes and stuff like that is certainly true, but T.S. Eliot also used a lot of Greek mythology and alluded to other literary references. For example, in The Wasteland, Tiresias, who was a prophet or like a seer.
Like Marcus Lemonis.
Yes, he was just like Mark. He came in.
He's a prophet and a seer.
He went to the Acropolis and he came into the fruit stands at the Acropolis and he was like, "I hear your fruit stand is struggling.
I'm going to give you 1 million drachma.
A million drachma for 40% of your fruit stand." No.
Man. The ancient prophet needs to be like an SNL sketch.
Okay. We're going to write it. We'll perform it on Song Salad, Ancient Prophet.
The Ancient Prophet.
Yeah. Anyway. So what I'm saying is I'm going to give myself leeway to reference kind of big, famous figures and ideas in ancient literature.
Okay.
If they help me to kind of draw this larger conclusion and make a bigger, more universal impact with what I'm trying to say about measuring the worth in your life. Also, your cat has litter all over its paws and it's touching your face.
Great.
Oh.
It's made of corn. It's fine.
Ugh, and poop.
It's made of poop. Ugh. Musically, I'm going to start with a rock band and find sounds, soundscapes, sound effects that I think might work well to represent the 2004 presidential campaign.
Okay.
And the highlights of an art rock song can include changes in time signature, changes in key, and the structure can be broken up a little bit more than a standard verse chorus structure. So in your lyrics, feel free to play with that structure, and musically I can reflect that.
True. All right.
Here we go, I guess.
Question mark? Oh boy, I really went for this.
That's what we're supposed to do.
Yeah, I ran hard at this one.
Okay, you channeled your inner Eliot.
I did, and I think that if this were freshman Survey of Forms poetry class back at Carnegie Mellon and we were doing our imitation poems,
yeah,
and I picked T.S. Eliot to imitate,
this would be an A+.
I think this would be an A+.
Okay.
I think Professor Jerry Costanzo would give me an A+.
All right. Do you want to preface anything before you actually read the lyrics, or do you want to just launch into it?
I will preface. I'll say a couple things.
Okay.
I'll say that we found a quote of Mr. Gephardt conceding the
House speakership,
thank you, to Newt Gingrich.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a great quote. So I've taken it and I've poeticized it.
Okay.
Which I'll point out when we get to it. I've also made a bunch of references to T.S. Eliot.
Oh.
Because that feels in keeping with T.S. Eliot, since he was always referring to great works of art and mythology and the Bible and Shakespeare.
And now he's that.
Yeah, he is in the canon. So I referenced a bunch of stuff from T.S. Eliot. I also have a Shakespearean reference. I have a biblical reference.
Okay.
I have, let's go.
All right, read them.
Okay, here we go. And there's no structure to this.
Oh, good.
Yeah. I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker. Old rivals haunt the halls I lately hallowed. Dean, who holds my coat, conceals a snicker. And the cowboy chevalier shouts freedom and unity. The long arc of life's justice bends towards mediocrity. But who can weigh the sum I've blindly bartered blithely, clasping flesh for votes to claim one's pound of flesh? My leaden mantle's rind grows somewhat hoary, and in the attic pickled teacup of defeat, scarce the drops of glory.
Oh my God.
Wait, it's still going.
There's more.
And indeed, there will be time to reflect on the sublime, the molecular breath, the blink, the sharp inhale of impatient night before the stone is finally rolled across and steals the light.
This is going to be like a 20-minute long song.
It's not that much text.
Yeah, but like when I talk about my music, you'll hear how the text is going to be pretty spaced out.
Oh, no. So. Oh, no. Well, all right. That's in keeping with art rock. It's all eight minutes.
Well, I guess, yeah. If you normally have a radio play song at 2 to 3 minutes and the art rock songs are like 8 to 10, we normally have like 30-second to 1-minute songs. Yeah. So maybe this one will be like 4 minutes.
Great. Let me point out some of the references I made. So there are a couple lines that I've lifted directly verbatim from Proof Rock. Those are, I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker.
Yeah.
And indeed there will be time. And the I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker is part of a line that I also kind of reference. The lines in Proof Rock are, I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker, and I have seen the eternal footman hold my coat and snicker.
Yeah.
Which is the reference to Dean, who holds my coat, conceals a snicker. I also have this line, and the cowboy chevalier.
So I was going to ask about that line.
Yeah. So the cowboy chevalier is Dean going, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So which is like, I kind of tried to do this highbrow, lowbrow thing. So like the cowboy is lowbrow, chevalier is French for knight, right, like a knight in shining armor.
That's good.
And then he shouts freedom and unity, which is the state motto of Vermont.
Oh.
And he is from Vermont.
Very nice.
The next line, the long arc of life's justice bends towards mediocrity.
Uh-huh.
You know, there is a like famous saying by Dr. King, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Yeah.
And so I've kind of taken that and perverted it a bit to the long arc of life's justice bends towards mediocrity, because you're like, you're weighing merits and demerits, and they kind of all come out in the end toward mediocrity.
Bleak.
Yes. Clasping flesh for votes to claim one's pound of flesh. One's pound of flesh is an expression coined in The Merchant of Venice by William Shakespeare.
Yep.
And it is like taking what is rightfully yours, but in a kind of humane and horrible manner.
Okay.
Oh, goodness. And then, I'm so sorry. I packed so much. That's the thing about T.S. Eliot is like, you can read it and just enjoy his language. But also, if you are like a
bibliophile,
yeah, you can kind of peel open every phrase like an onion and find all this stuff inside it, you know? So the phrase that Dick Gephardt says when he concedes to Newt Gingrich is, when you carry the mantle of progress, there is precious little glory in defeat. And that became, my leaden mantle's rind grown somewhat hoary, and in the attic pickled teacup of defeat, scarce the drops of glory.
Jesus. Of course it became that. That's what I would have written too.
I told you, I like ran at it. So grown somewhat hoary, H-O-A-R-Y, means like white or gray.
Okay.
And I'm using that as like a metaphor. So like my leaden mantle, like he is carrying the mantle, this kind of burden, the outside of the mantle grown somewhat hoary, like growing gray, like he's getting older.
Okay.
So it's a kind of
cool
way to talk about that. And then the last thing I will say in the last sort of like verse here, we have to reflect on the sublime, which is like hearkening back to our conversation about romantic poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, indeed, there will be time to reflect on it in just this like tiny, teeny little moment before the stone is finally rolled across, which is a reference to the stone of Jesus's tomb,
right,
being rolled across and steals the light, meaning death, like death, yes, steals out the light of the mortal living realm.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. You achieved the goal of like our prompt. So
yeah,
it's a lot. It's great.
Thank you. Why don't you tell me about your bleeps and bloops?
I've got some bleeps and bloops to accompany it. I went for like a 70s jam band rock kind of feel where I put a lot of reverb, which is that like echoey distant sound, onto the drums, the electric guitar, and the bass. And the electric guitar is playing a like very minimalist, kind of like repeated drone-y type chordal pattern. So here's what that electric guitar will sound like in the intro.
Cool.
And then I use some effects that are still based in like the realm of rock music. So I have this like reverse guitar effect. And that was something that the Beatles did a lot, was they would play something and then play the tape in reverse and put that sound onto the final track. So
whoa,
they would do this a lot with their guitar sounds. John Lennon would do this with his vocals a lot. And famously, John Lennon didn't like the way his voice sounded, so he would often pitch it higher or lower, like sing the song in a different key and pitch his voice into the key that the band recorded it in to give his voice a different, unique sound.
Whoa.
So vocally, I would like to do that as
oh
well.
Oh my goodness.
There was something that happened when we were recording earlier.
Oh, yes.
We had a technical glitch. I don't know what caused it. Like, it was some kind of failure within Logic.
Ghost in the wires.
Yeah. It caused your voice to like scramble and get high pitched, and it just sounded really cool. And
it
we
did.
Recorded it. So here's what that sounds like. And I'm incorporating that into the song, because why not? It happened organically.
It's art. It's avant-garde.
I also took that quote that you mentioned from Dick Gephardt from when he was handing the gavel over to Newt Gingrich, and I have that opening the song with the sound of a mixture of a crowd cheering and a crowd booing layered over top of each other, because it's like, did they love him? Did they hate him? We don't know.
I love it. I love the I love the ambiguity.
Exactly.
The ambivalence is
right.
Great.
Yeah, and there's still more that I'm probably going to layer in now that I know what the lyrics are. So I think a lot of what you're going to hear will end up being a surprise, listeners.
To all of us.
The only other thing I know that I definitely want to do is add some background like oohs and these kind of like choral ahs in the background, because one, there was a lot of music at this time that incorporated the sound of a choir singing. For example, one of the bands that we use as an example, Pink Floyd, the song Brick in the Wall, they have like a bunch of people in the background like chanting and singing along. So like I want to create that sense of like a group performing the
cool.
piece, and also reflect the voters and the people that he represented. So
reflect the voters. What the hell are we gonna call this?
Let me look at the lyrics.
I mean, my first instinct is we could call it Dick Gephardt for President.
We could. I mean, we could call it that. We could call it Dick Gephardt's 2004 presidential campaign. But if we are going to draw from the lyrics, I would say precious little glory, which is from his quote.
Yeah, that
might
is
be
his
good.
Quote. The mantle of progress.
The mantle of progress. Scarce the drops of glory.
Scarce the drops of glory is so dramatic.
It is.
I'm leaning toward like Gephardt for President or something.
Okay.
Or like some kind of campaign thing. Vote for Dick.
Vote for Dick.
Vote for Dick is kind of funny because it also reflects a lot of these bands had like a sense of humor, a kind of tongue in cheekness.
True.
Like I'm thinking of the
Frank Zappa. Don't eat the yellow snow.
Yeah. Frank Zappa. Don't eat yellow snow. You know, like it was humorous.
Yeah. Let's go for it.
Vote for Dick.
Vote for Dick. Here is Vote for Dick.
An art rock song
about Dick Gephardt's 2004 presidential campaign.
By Shannon and Scott.
Ladies and gentlemen of the House, I first want to thank my Democratic colleagues for their support and their confidence. When you carry the mantle of progress, there is precious little glory in defeat. 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 Defeat.
I have seen the moment of my greatness flicker. Old rivals haunt the halls I lately hallowed. He who holds my coat conceals a snicker, and the cowboy chevalier shouts.
The long arc of life's justice bends toward mediocrity. But who can weigh the sun and blindly barter blithely?
Clasping flesh for votes to claim one's pound of flesh. My leaden mantle rind gropes on one hoary. And in the attic pickled teacup of defeat. Scarce the drops of glory,
glory, glory.
And indeed there will be time to reflect on the sublime.
The molecular breath, the breath, the molecular breath, the blink, the shot in the head.
Oh guys.
You can catch us on tour performing just that song.
I was going to say you could catch us in like a independent bookstore reading our poetry out loud.
That's true too.
To a bunch of stoned people.
Yeah. I mean, probably goes without saying that a lot of this music was created for people on drugs by people on drugs.
For the users, by the users.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But I think we were pretty successful in creating something that could have existed in the world of art rock at this time in the history of music.
Yeah, avant-garde, trying purposely to defy convention and break rules.
Yes.
A healthy sense of snobbery.
Yep.
And intellectualism.
Mm-hmm. But not virtuosity in the playing of the instruments,
right,
which would have taken this into the realm of prog rock or
right,
even math rock, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And we learned about Dick Gephardt.
We did. I mean, he was like never anyone on my radar because like I wasn't voting in 2004,
yeah,
you know, and I wasn't paying attention to any candidates that weren't the party's nominee, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, really. Except for Howard Dean, just because of his cowboy chevalier yell. So now we know.
Now we know. And now we know a lot more about a lot of stuff. We covered a lot of ground in this episode, didn't we?
T.S. Eliot, cats,
World War One, romanticism.
I was saying to someone the other day that Song Salad tricks you into learning things. So I hope it does that for you, listener.
Hey, listener, if you've learned something from today's episode, tweet. tweet at us at Song Salad Cast.
Yeah, we love to hear from you. You can also join our Facebook group, Song Salad Podcast, the produce section, where you can post longer than 280 character descriptions of things you're thinking about.
Guys, everyone who's in the produce section is a gem.
I love the produce section.
It's great. And speaking of the produce section, full of our wonderful listeners, thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. And thank you especially for reviewing.
Yeah.
If you would like to give us a review, we'll read a little bit of your review and shout you out on the show because we super appreciate it and helps people find us.
And we would love to thank our Patreon donors. You guys are the best.
You're amazing. Thank you for your continued support of us and our crazy show.
And until next week.
I'm Shannon.
And I'm Scott.
And we're reminding you that
Dick Gephardt makes the best salads.
I was going to say that a pair of ragged claws makes the best salads.
What?
Like a crab salad.
Salad.